Hello, and welcome back to Big Mouth, the pop culture podcast with marginally better sound quality than the Spice Girls reunion tour. I'm Andrew Harrison, and joining me as usual is Sean Pattenden, the carefree and confident Mel C, to my desperate and anxious Jerry Halliwell. Hello, Sean. How are you? And did you have a pleasant bank holiday weekend?
Very pleasant. I spent it listening to Tyler, the Creator, mainly.
Really?
Gawping at how amazing he is. He's just become the best pop star ever, as we may discuss later.
We may discuss later, yes. Yeah. My favourite bit of the bank holiday weekend was going to All Points East in London's Victoria Park to see a variety of bands. But when Primal Screamer on Bobby Gillespie decided he was going to do a birthday dedication to his wife, and he goes, "This one's for you, babe. I love you. This is called Swastika Eyes." Going to do the most beautiful, heartfelt thing, you know. The audience were guffawing. Particularly too parasitic, you're syphilitic. Hi, babe. Doesn't really go down very well.
Maybe she liked it.
Maybe she likes it. It's probably their song. Mm. Anyway, on this week's show, we're going to be looking at Rocket Man, the Elton John biopic starring Taron Egerton. It's been praised as a sensory overload that really puts you in the tortured brain of the future Sir Elton, both at the height of his fame and in the depths of his ice cream, cockles and cocaine misery. But it's also been described as a bit of a hatchet job on certain Elton enemies. What did we think about it? And we'll also be listening to the eighth album by modern-day Roy Orbison turned Sheffield shaman Richard Hawley. How is middle age treating the most pendulous quiff in the West Riding of Yorkshire? And what is he saying about our stage of life? Also, we have a very special guest this week. In the 1990s, Phil Savage ran the Politburo of Pop as PR for some of the defining bands of the era. Pulp, Suede, Elastica, The Verve, The Auteurs, Savage and Best, which he ran with his partner John Best, had them all, as well as other, more of their time artists like Menswear, Powder, Shampoo, Space, Dubstar and Ultrasound. Phil knows where the bodies are buried, having murdered several of them himself, and it's all in his memoir, Lunch with the Wild Frontiers, which is out now. Hello, Phil Savage. Welcome to Big Mouth. How are you doing?
I'm doing very well. How are you?
I'm very well. Delighted to see you again after too long. We're going to talk about the book in some detail in a minute, but writing the book is often the death of being a PR. Once you've finally spilled the beans.
Oh, good.
Right, yes. Did you have any qualms about...
Absolutely not, no. I think I might say a couple of times in the book that I've been trying to stop being a PR ever since I got into it.
Yes.
So writing about that obviously might have, you know, stopped all my ambition in that direction, as they say.
So every time you meet a new client, you can hand them the book and go, you do realise that all this will come out.
I guess I shouldn't go around talking about it, shouldn't I, really?
Without giving the ending away, it does kind of finish with you disengaging from music PR, just as it turns out that the NME are using market research to find out whether they should cover Suede or not.
That has kind of given the ending away, but I don't mind. It's in the telling of it, of that particular
bit. It's the journey. Yeah. It's like Game of Thrones. Yeah. We sort of know how it's going to end, but we need to know why it ends that way. Do you think that business that you were so adept at of kind of creating a story, has that sort of died, or has it just moved to another place?
Well, it's certainly my theory that internet and marketing have killed the art of PR. Hmm. And I think I start the book off with an anecdote where I used to look after this band called the 25th of May, who were kind of like agit, you know, pop or what they're called.
Yeah.
And I used to pretend there were riots at all their gigs. And so tell the melody maker to call an outraged promoter in Newcastle, and they'd call them, and a friend of theirs who just happened to live in Newcastle with a perfectly Newcastle accent, you say, yeah, there was riots last night, you know. So then they print the story. So I realised then you could create stories. You can't do that anymore because, obviously, people check their facts. If you go into a radio station, for instance, you've got a new band and say, will you play this new record? They won't really be listening to you. They'll be looking at the Facebook profile of the band, seeing if it's the right demographic to fit in with the profile of the station. Yeah. And that's not quite right, I don't think.
Checking your facts, the death of journalism.
Yeah, I know, it is, yeah.
Yeah, print the legend. I absolutely agree with this. We're going to get into detail on Lunch with the Wild Frontiers, including why it's called Lunch with the Wild Frontiers, after these short reminders from Sean.
Remember, you can get every edition of Big Mouth a day early by supporting us with a few quid on the crowdfunding platform Patreon. We're asking for the mere price of a pint, just £5 a month, and we'll send you each episode of the show as soon as it's ready. You'll get the extra bit too, exclusive to our Patreon backers. This week, Phil is going to stick around, and we are going to confess to our personal best and worst moments in the glory days of Britpop. That's Phil there. Search Patreon Big Mouth to find out more. Also, don't forget Andrew's full night of New Order at Fancy Pants Audio Bar Spiritland in London's King's Cross next Thursday, June the 6th. He's doing a Spiritland Legends session featuring the best, weirdest and most obscure of the Mancunian gloom merchants turned ravers, and we are promised it will be heavy on the Jillian. Yes,
very heavy please. On the Jillian, yes.
Admission is free, yay! It's 8 p.m. to 1 a.m. at Spiritland, Granary Square, King's Cross, Thursday, 6th of June. It's going to be like the Hacienda, but better.
miles better. Thanks, Sean. Now, remember those days, the early 90s, when every skinny layabout in the land moved to Camden Town to catch pints in the Good Mixer and almost certainly become a pop star because it was all so easy back then? Former music PR Phil Savage has captured a large slice of those heady days in his book Lunch with the Wild Frontiers. And before we talk about it, let's get in the mood with some representative tunes. Get your mum's blouse on. Here's Elastica with Connection, Suede with Metal Mickey, and Pulp with This Is Hardcore. Oh, how I miss being relevant. Phil, the book is extremely funny, as well as quite sad for the passing of an era. It's like P.G. Woodhouse had fallen through a time hole and bought a chemise from Cancer Research and started hanging around in the Bull and Gate. What made you want to write it? Did you feel a purgative need?
If I could just pick up on something, you've already started calling me former music PR.
Yeah, well,
which I quite like, actually. Mm-hmm. What made me start writing it?
What made you want to start writing it?
Well, I've written my whole life. I've always tried to write, you know, a novel, as most people have, and it's always petered out, and I've written biographies and sleeve notes, and about 3 years ago I tore the ligaments in my left knee because I run every day,
right,
and I couldn't run anymore or walk, so I thought I'd better do some writing. So I showed some stories to somebody and they said these are great, so I showed them to an agent. He said, have you got any more? I said yes, which I lied about. and then I thought, you know, I'll just see if I've got enough for a whole book. And then they kind of exist as kind of like short stories in their own right, which you can dip in and out of, though I advise you not to do that, but they kind of they kind of scoot ahead as well, you know, into you know, so I grab an anecdote from the future and drag it back. But every chapter starts chronologically after the last one started. But as to my motivation, I guess I just had to do it, really.
Mm. It's a tale that needed to be told. Do you feel that the 90s get their due? They tend to get buried under these kind of awful fat bloke guitar rock revival tours, and they forget the, you know, the exciting, odd, weird Dogman star, different class style, where it's quite intelligent and also very, very kind of louche and you know, androgynous as well. It wasn't just like a fat bloke trying to be.
No, I think it became less androgynous when Oasis arrived from Manchester, obviously, and I think, you know, that Ted Kessler said the other day that when they started releasing records as a competitive sport, which I think is kind of true, because before all that, it was kind of innocent. You know, all the bands were sitting around in Syndrome. Everyone was talking to each other. Well, journalists were in bands, you know, as well. And I think everyone was the same age. And Oasis came along and kind of made it a bit more. The rivalry that Suede and Blur had, for instance, felt kind of like someone was childish, you know, like, you know, because of the Justine connection, etc. And the fact that Blur went away to America for a tour. And by the time they came back, Suede were on the cover of the NME. And they didn't know how that had happened, because when they'd left, Suede were nothing, you know? So that was kind of but that was kind of like, it was something very innocent about that. And then when Oasis arrived, their rivalry with Blur was really serious and nasty. You know, they said some horrible things about each other. So I thought kind of it changed a bit then for me.
It does make me realise, actually, that, you know, loads of us got into music because we were no good at football, no good at fighting, and no good at those things. And then music gets turned into football, another bloody competitive sport.
But I also think that the Oasis' arrival made bands like Suede and Blur change. I think Suede were quite effete, you know, and Blur were not quite so laddie as they became, because I'm sure those bands thought maybe we're being discarded because we're slightly too, well, I don't know, fey. And, you know, sort of Brett cut his hair off and stopped spanking his arse. And Damon started writing, you know, about, you know, hanging around in a park.
Being a bloke. The book is an entertainment in its own right. And you know, most of the many of the really entertaining things are not to do with music at all. You know, you growing up in prep school in Nottingham with, and one kid's dad was Tom Baker. Did you ever meet Tom Baker?
Yeah, he used to come to the school gate all the time. Yeah,
really?
Yeah, with his very long scarf. Yeah,
did you and the kids mob him?
Yeah, it was exactly like it would be now if Justin Bieber was a dad at school or something.
What a much more healthy statement. First. But I was really taken by your dad and his kind of slightly buttoned-upness and his inability to get his head around your terrible Poncy pop music.
Yes.
And particularly his phrases, like when somebody asks him, would he like a cup of Earl Grey? And his response is, I haven't got time for experiments.
Yeah, that was, but not in such a... He was a very gentle man, my dad. So that was when he came to London from Nottingham. And he just popped in to sort of visit me and obviously, you know, to sit around and look around at my Poncy flat, etc., with my Poncy friends. So it was me that offered him a cup of Earl Grey.
Right. That's a very Poncy form of tea, isn't
it?
When you think about it. You accidentally fall into music PR and you kind of end up doing G.G. Allin. What are your key memories of noted scatological rock and roller G.G. Allin?
Well, thankfully, I never met him.
Oh,
but his brother came to the door of the PR office I was working in. But it could have been G.G. Allin because he had a very badly put on beard, I thought. And I think it was after I burnt all the records in the back garden and told everybody that I'd done it. And I think he might have found out and was angry about it. And obviously that was because at the time I didn't know. I thought he was just like a Frank Zappa figure who just, you know, comically ate shit on stage or something. Instead, of course, he was, he advocated violence and rape. And I didn't realise that until I looked at the lyric sheet. That's why I burnt all the records in the bottom of the garden.
That's what I call proper PR.
Yes.
You moved on to Virgin Records doing sort of strange sort of end of 80s bands like It Bites and Wendy and Lisa. But you did have quite a nice little moment with Roy Orbison.
Yes. Some people say they cry reading that chapter. I mean, I certainly cried, not when I was writing it, but at the time when I was, you know, representing him, because he obviously died, you know, towards, you know, whilst I was looking after him. And his wife, his manager Barbara, had flown to America. And so she said goodbye to him, and then he stayed around with me doing more press and stuff. And then he flew back to see his mum, and he had a heart attack in his mother's arms. And I remember thinking, I saw Roy closer to his death than his beloved wife. That feels somehow wrong. And I don't know if that's an idiotic thought, but it really crossed my mind at the time, and I was really upset. And that's also when I noticed, when I went to Virgin Records later that morning, because it was announced on the radio early in the morning, and they were playing Pretty Woman on the radio, and I got in there, couldn't get in the office because there were flowers everywhere, and I was called straight to an emergency meeting, and someone said, well, of course, this might be good for record sales. And I just thought, you know, it's like 3 hours ago, you didn't know he was dead, and all you know you want to do is sell the record. And that really pissed me off.
Yeah. What was he like, Roy Orbison? Because I imagine he was a kind of like a form of gentleman, you know, pre-rock star.
Very, very Texan. I mean, he smoked Marlboro Red. And he had long hair with a ponytail all the time. I kept seeing him when he came out of the shower in a towel, because I think he always had forgotten that I was coming to see him. And also I was so nervous. I arrived 3 hours early for the first, you know, interview I was organising, walked around the square for 3 hours, and then I introduced him to Nick Kent. And there's the part of that story is me trying to tell Nick Kent that Roy Orbison wanted him to write this biography, and me trying to track down Nick Kent.
Savage and Best, the PR empire that you and John Best put together, was definitely a power in the land. And lots of our listeners will have an inkling of how close the relationship was between Music PRs and the Weekly Press in particular. But could you actually strong arm or con a journalist into covering a band out of the blue? Obviously not people like me and Sean.
Yeah.
I mean, we're immune to that kind of thing. But
I don't think I've strong armed anybody. I'm not that kind of person. I think you can be a bit clever about it. I mean, there's a story in the book about, you know, it can be a bit cute, I guess. You know, there was the Suede's third single, Animal Nitrate, which I thought was a real game changer. And because I'd seen them play it live so many times, I really wanted it to have an effect. So I sellotaped a cassette copy of that to a purple velvet cushion that we'd had hanging around in our office, and then biked it to the NME with a note that said, another great disappointment. Just hoping that they would appreciate the irony. I mean, somebody stupid would have gone, oh, they don't like this, then they've said another. But, you know, I knew that there'd be some intelligence the NME found somewhere, and, you know, we've got a single of the week. So you can be a bit cute about it without strong-arming somebody. And then once you get a reputation, people listen to your opinion more, which is why I hate the internet. and that's why, you know, I say in the book that Elastica formed in our office, because I said, well, you're beautiful, you're rich, you're surrounded by beautiful people, you go out with Damon, you used to go out with Brett. Not a bad idea, really, is it? Mm. And then before they'd really record, there was a demo going around in our office with a couple of tracks on, and the Melody Maker rang up and said, we want to do a feature on Elastica. And I said, well, if you do a piece on them, you can't put them on the cover. And then I heard one of them put the phone to his like to his chest and was shouted across the office, Phil Savage, you're turning down the cover for Elastica. And then he came back on the phone and said, yeah, we'll do them then. And then they put them on the cover just to piss me off. But I knew exactly what I was doing. And, you know, they got a cover, I'm sure, because I was being cute.
So what was the best cue you pulled off? And don't you dare say Select.
Gosh. Well, that Elastica one was pretty special, I suppose. I'm going to say the Select one then. because I know you
let's have the heated debate.
Yeah,
come
you
on,
were heavily
Phil.
Involved in that. And, I never claim.
Only at the 11 of editing the magazine, it was a minor involvement.
I never claimed to have invented the word Britpop, you know, but I claim to have invented Britpop. There's a difference.
For our younger listeners, this is when we put Brett on the cover of Select with the Union Jack in the background, and it was heading up a big feature that had Denim and Saint Etienne and the O'Tears and Pulp and a handful of other people in there as the brightly coloured world of...
So three out of five of those bands were Savage and Best bands, obviously. So this is where I rest my case. For me, Pulp had been in the Enemy and Melody Maker like several times over the last year. They weren't important enough, apparently, to be in a magazine, to get a feature in a magazine. The only way to get them in there was to lump them in with other bands, new bands. So they were in that feature so that the people at Select who loved Pulp could actually justify getting them in the magazine in the first place. Mm. The other thing that we got at the same time was that Q had just put Suede on the front cover a month before with the headline. Well, it's inside. It said that discography in full with two singles beneath it, and that was the lowest selling copy of Q ever, which I was very proud of at the time. So they'd taken a chance, but Select couldn't be seen to follow them because that was an old man's title. So how can we do Suede? Thought the editor, and then of course we'll make this movement. So there's a whole lot of synergy going on here, Andrew, wasn't there? Really,
there's a whole lot of synergy. I mean, a person might say that those groups were already part of a thing and you facilitated it, but we can have that heated debate later. Amongst all the things that you're also handling, at one point you had all the four AD bands and the Farm at the same time, an interesting combination. Yeah. Did you find that bands would sort of run into each other in the office and there would be...
Well, I could never really handle the Farm. I mean, they were just not... I mean, that single was great, but they lived in their own little world, you know? Mm. And I used to go down to Top of the Pops with them every week for like 5 weeks, and God knows how I survived, because I'm sure they just took the piss out of me the whole time behind my back. Mm. But they came in the office yet? And the four AD bands were more mysterious, believe it or not.
Really?
Yeah.
They just hide behind a lot of gauze.
Exactly.
What do you think is was there a moment where you thought, we really have got away with murder on something here? We really have made something famous.
Yes. Well, they're absolutely. Cooler Shaker.
Yeah.
Even though Melissa looked after them in the office and she did a great job, when I heard them and I knew that their heritage of Crispian and his dad, etc., and his mum, or his granddad and his mum, and I just thought, well, they're obviously going to happen. You know, it's going to happen. So if we don't do them, somebody else will do them. So let's do them. But I personally hated them. Thought they were contrived and just, said, if somebody else wants to do them in the office, you can do it. And I'll just stand around. But I remember being at Tea in the Park, and this is mentioned in the book as well, where they were playing in a field. I think I was walking along with Polly, and Polly said, look, Cooler Shaker on over there, and I put my hands on my head and went, I shall never see them.
You also had to handle the Bernard Butler leaving stroke being invited to leave Suede moment, just as Dogman Star, their big sort of reach for longevity in the Grand Art statement happened. And I remember having to deal with you in a state of mild panic as you were sort of keeping a very clear, calm surface on.
That felt so important at the time. In fact, I was going to pick that as my lowest moment in Britpop, but I thought I'd do something even more personal than that. That was a really strange moment, obviously. And that was, I mean, again, this is all in the book, but that's when I noticed that Brett was panicking a bit because, Bernard's brilliance, and their partnership together meant that the pressure was off Brett in a way, but now the pressure was back on because he had to find another guitarist. It could be all over. The dream was over as far as everyone's concerned. So the best way to deal with that is to just not put a cover on it, but you just think as if it's not the most important thing in the world, even though in that little world it was pretty massive. So you got to make sure everybody knew there was a track on the record that Bernard didn't play on at all. And then they found a new guitarist in the same way that they found Bernard in an ad in Melody Maker, who was 16. So you put all these positives in, people forget the fact that Bernard was an incredible guitarist and it might have all been over.
Who was the most fun to work with?
Of all the people?
Hmm.
Well, I really enjoyed working with Brett because it was kind of hedonistic, and obviously everything you did on him ended up on a cover. There was lots of pressure all the time, but that was really, and also the Swayze music I loved so much as well.
Yeah.
But I think I mean, other than that, I guess Pulp as well, really. Pulp, because there were so many great moments. You know, realizing at one point I thought there was just us in the office that liked them, or just magazines that liked them. And once you let them go, even though you're not actually doing anything yourself, they become brilliant on their own. You kind of take a joy in that, really.
Is there a band that you represented that you thought should have made it and never did?
I guess
massive.
If you say that Ultrasound didn't make it, which I guess they didn't, because their album only went to like number 27 or something, but their four singles are astonishing, and obviously I know he's been called the most unlikely frontman in pop because of his hefty nature, etc. But their songwriting is incredible, and, you know, and I still listen to those songs now and can't, you know, it's like, you know, indie Hawkwind pop or something.
Did you think as well that? I think of Britpop as sort of before the tabloids and after the tabloids. The tabloids seized on the Britpop, Oasis and Blur stuff. Yeah. How difficult did that make your job? And how different did it make the job? Suddenly music press.
I couldn't handle it because I was meant to be speaking to them. They were the enemy for me. And in fact, the only thing that stopped me when I took on Fat Les later, and Keith Allen said to me, we've got to be in the sun every day. You know, keep your enemies close, he said. And I thought, okay, well, if that's what I'm charged to do, I'll do it then. But before that, when the Britpop thing went over to the tabloids, I couldn't deal with it at all. I would avoid phone calls. And there was one situation where I think it might have been Matthew Wright, that he wrote something in the paper about Jarvis, I think it was. And then I didn't, you know, he said, you know, I'm expecting a call from the PR. And I didn't call. And then the next day he did it again. And I didn't call. And the next day he started saying, Savage & Best must be the worst PR company in Britain. And at this point, I could handle it. But a couple of people were going, this just looks really bad now, Phil, because it's affecting everybody. It was because I didn't want to deal with these people, you know. And then I rang him and said, all right, Matthew. And then he went, that's all I wanted, a phone call, you know, because they're going to win in the end. They've got so much power, haven't they?
It's the depressing feature of like that kind of thing. Basically, always swamps everything good and ruins it in the end. One thread running through it is you're sort of very ahead of the game. Fondness for non-gender conforming dress and self-presentation.
Oh, is that true?
Do you think Brett might have borrowed a little bit of that?
I don't know.
You're ahead of the game.
I don't know. I do remember being at a face photo session once with Brett, and the makeup artist said to Brett, "Oh, you're quite feminine, aren't you?" And he said, God, you should see my PR.
I think that was a story I wrote, actually, for the face. Yeah,
oh, yeah. And so obviously there's lots of moments in the book where, you know, my gender is confused and it makes for, you know, comedy moments, etc. You know, with like couriers coming in and then just thinking I'm Melissa or something. And I encouraged that and it was fun. So, you know, I was ahead of my time.
There you go. Yeah, you invented it.
Yeah.
Do you think, I mean, I think one of the reasons that, obviously, I love the whole Britpop thing because I was having a great time on a magazine that was doing really, really well, and like our kind of music was becoming successful.
And as Phil's saying, oddly, and as much as pop stars hate this, the gap between pop star and journalist was actually the thinnest I've ever seen it. We were all going to the same things. Yes.
But also pop star.
I saw you there.
Yes. Yeah, pop star was really thin as well because the followers were all there.
Yeah. It's egalitarian, man. Yeah.
But do you think one of the reasons it looks, you know, even more fun in retrospect is that like things like that just can't happen now? You can't have a little incubated scene.
No, it's all teams of people protecting other people from finding out the truth when the truth is not as bad as people think half the time.
Yeah. We never explained why it's called Lunch with the Wild Frontiers. Why is it called Lunch with the Wild Frontiers?
Another thing I've got to reveal live. okay, it's called, well, for a start, I didn't want to call it My Life in Britpop because that's pathetic. And that's what one headline said in the paper the other day. I thought, God, I've been trying to avoid that. So it's called that because my very first day at Virgin Records in June 1988... I was the first person in, obviously, because I was completely nervous about the whole thing. I opened up my diary, which is empty, apart from the words Lunch with the Wild Frontiers. I thought, what does that mean? That must mean lunch in the Wild Frontiers. That must be a pub. And then, of course, I waited till the head of press came in. I said, what does this mean? And she said, well, that's a band called the Wild Frontiers. You've got to go to an Ethiopian restaurant at lunchtime. And I go there, meet this band. Well, they come in a taxi to pick me up, and it's Marco Peroni from Adam and the Ants, who obviously had an album called Kings of the Wild Frontier.
Ah.
And so I go to the restaurant, come back, la-di-da. They're a rubbish band. They get dropped within 6 weeks. And then I thought, I've had that title in my head for a long, long time. If I was going to write a memoir, that would be the title. But I thought it was too obscure. So anyway, as I was writing it, I started Googling Wild Frontiers to find out. And even though Marco Peroni's got a really big web presence, etc., you know, he catalogues every moment of his waking life, there's nothing about the Wild Frontiers anywhere. So they've been airbrushed from history. So
Not anymore.
Yes.
Now they are immortalised. Yes. Well, I found it fantastic. It's the Stars and Bars of Britpop.
Certainly
what else is it? It's
there's a picture of me in it, Andrew Harrison.
And there's no picture of me in it, so no, thanks for that, Phil.
I didn't pick that.
It's very good. Entertaining read. Blocks of cocaine. That's what we need to read about.
Yes, see if you can work out who the giant block of cocaine belongs to. Anyway.
Right in.
Before we move on, here's Phil's favourite track from back then. This is Suede and The Chemistry Between Us.
We've got to move on. Rocket Man is the much heralded Elton John movie and a second entry into the rock mega biopic genre for director Dexter Fletcher from Out of Press Gang, who's finished off Bohemian Rhapsody after Bryan Singer was fired. Taron Egerton plays the piano puncher from Pinner in a selection of audacious headgear and statement spectacles. Richard Madden is his manager and lover, John Reed, and Jamie Bell is surprisingly swaggering as Bernie Taupin. But does the movie play fast and loose with events? Probably it's a movie. Let's have a taster.
Feeling in tune.
I could hear the whole tune in my head. It was all there, I could see all the notes, and I just had to get it out.
It's a little bit funny. This feeling inside.
What did you say your name was again?
My name is
Reggie!
So that is a fat boy from nowhere. Get to be a soul man.
Gotta kill the person you were born to be in order to become the person you wanna be.
I'm thinking of changing my name to Elton.
But that's my name.
So how does it feel to be a star?
It's never gonna last.
Let's just enjoy it while we can.
First sleeping arrangements, kiddo. All of this is gone.
I just hope you realise you're choosing a life of being alone forever.
Don't you want to just sing without this ridiculous paraphernalia?
People don't pay to see Reg White. They pay to see Elton John.
Sorry. Pennon.
Care how much pressure I'm under.
Not really. I'll still be collecting my 20% long after you've killed yourself.
Maybe I should have tried to be more ordinary.
You were never ordinary.
It'll be all Dwight on the night.
Mm.
Rocket Man, the Elton John story, currently tearing up a cinema near you. Phil Savage, you went to see this at the weekend with your kids, I believe.
Oh, no, that's what I said in advance. But, of course, I turned up at the cinema to find out that 12-year-old and 9-year-old are not allowed in. So I had to go and see Secret Life of Pets 2. So then, of course, fast forward to 24 hours later I did go and see it on my own. And I hate musicals, I must admit. Mm-hmm. But I love this film. And I can't work out the history of how this got to the cinema, whether there is a stage musical somewhere called Rocket Man that's come, because it looked exactly like a stage musical on screen. And it made, when I came out of the cinema, you know, I ran out of the cinema and just wanted to cancel concerts and order loads of Charlie, basically. And I only did one of those things. That's why I cancelled concerts. But I loved it. And as I say, I hate musicals. So he's brilliant. You know, even though he doesn't quite look like Elton John, it doesn't matter. He's slightly overweight, which I think is important, you know, and, you know, but he can still dance. And I thought, the John Reed character, I mean, God, you know, no one's going to like him, are they?
Mm. No, they're not.
But Bernie Taupin comes over as lovely.
Yeah. Is this the least Phil music ever made, or are you Elton John fan of the music?
My sister introduced me to Elton John as a child, so I've always kind of loved Elton John, yes. I mean, I've heard he can be a bit precious, apparently. But yeah, I'm a big Elton John fan. I don't know how you could not like his music, really.
So this is all excess and pomp, isn't it? Do people in your trade envy those glory days? Does this make Britpop look like play school? That 70s was just the
wildest very dare you.
Well, read the book, find out.
Yeah, well, possibly, yes. I mean, I did come out thinking, God, what a life. You know, and he really did, you know. Yeah.
What I could have done with that.
Yeah, huge pints of vodka for breakfast. You know, that's kind of a bit out there, isn't it? I mean, the drug scenes are kind of almost, you know, even though they're kind of like fantasized, you know, with like dance sequences, etc., with like coke being passed through. They're quite unrealistic, but there is something very Wolf of Wall Street about it as well, I think.
Oh, that's a very good point. Yeah. Andrew, what did you make of this?
Well,
are you a fan, should we ask?
Absolutely
first?
Not. I've always found Elton. I mean, there's a handful. Obviously, anybody who's been in the business for 40 years is going to produce some songs you're going to enjoy, but generally speaking, I find Elton really, really hard to listen to. I really can't stand people who can really sing, and Elton can really sing, and that's what I really like. And yet I loved this. I also hate musicals. And yet I loved this. I really, really loved it. I thought it was so just utterly joyful, ludicrous, over the top, understood its own ludicrousness and over the topness, which is pure. It was the best side of what you want a star like Elton John to be. The framing of it is really interesting because it's told in flashback from an AA meeting, which, and this is hardly a spoiler, Elton turns up literally dressed as a flamboyant sequined devil with horns and demon wings. And as the film progresses, he pulls bits of the costume off himself, and he's literally stripping back the Eltonness of himself to find the real Elton inside. The fact that it's all presented in the context of fantasy sequences, little Reg, aged about 9, keeps appearing and talking to Elton.
He's cute, isn't he? You know?
He's great, And there's a moment where you think you've seen the last of him, and you think, oh, I want to see more of little Reg. But he keeps popping up again at crucial moments, such as the famous jumping in the swimming pool to kill yourself moment, well documented. I think Q magazine had this story about how John Reed had flown everybody to Los Angeles for Elton's birthday. To celebrate, you know, Elton turning the ripe old age of about 24 or something. Elton doesn't show up for hours and then runs out, having eaten a bottle of Valium, shouting, "I'm going to die," and throws himself in the swimming pool. This is rendered fairly faithfully.
Yes.
And there's an appearance for little Reg in that. I thought Taron Egerton was amazing. I think he did manage to look enough like Elton, but mostly he kind of conveys that combination of inner energy and total turmoil, that sort of, you know, absolute self-confidence and absolute self-loathing at the same time, and that kind of tragic neediness that drives the whole thing. I was completely won over by it.
I walked out of the cinema, I must admit, feeling stone cold. I thought I'd seen...
Didn't you cancel any concerts?
I didn't even order any cocaine. The characterisation was... victimised singer who's had a difficult life, bit of a tough dad. I mean, his parents are very much two-dimensional. But I thought there's no nuance to that. Has a bit of a drink and drugs problem and then becomes a good guy. And I didn't see anything else. And I'm now, obviously, having read those Mike Batt pieces and other members of the record industry who knew the management and him at the time, he does come across enormously heroic. And I felt that there wasn't a story there. There's also a complete disconnect in that this man is playing to hundreds of thousands of people. And we don't get an experience of what that's like and how he connects with people through the music. Also, AA meetings, we don't get anyone else's story. We don't get an idea of him interacting with anyone. It's just the solipsism then just put me off. Did anyone else feel that it was...
Well, the only thing I didn't
that's
like...
That's a difficult thing.
I mean, you know, if for my 4.99 review, five... Mm. The only thing I didn't like was at the end when, you know, you see those biopics of people who are unknown and they say, this is them now, you know, and this is what they did.
Such and such went on to join the Metropolitan Police.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. Yeah. And these are pictures of Elton now with his, you know, husband of 25 years who hasn't done drugs. Just pictures of Elton on the screen, you know, with all this lovely stuff about how great Elton is. And of course he's great and he's raised £500 million for AIDS, etc. I'm not sure whether we needed to know that. And I know the film's produced by David Furnish, and I could detect the hand of Furnish in that last, like, the last two-minute reel with all those things at the end. And I didn't quite... I didn't need that. Maybe I know... Everybody knows who Elton John is. Do we need that?
I don't know. I think you're right about the ending. The ending is quite abrupt, isn't it? It suddenly finished. We end up with, I'm clean now, and here's the I'm still standing video, which is one of the Elton Johns that I really, really detest.
Yes, and that's one of my favourites.
So. We'll never agree. But it's impressive the way the Taron Egerton is kind of patched into the original video.
Yes.
But it does end in a slightly Alan Partridge-y, needless to say, I had the last laugh thing. It has been criticised for giving a pretty cruel treatment to Dick James, the music publisher, who apparently was a very nurturing, fatherly chap.
Oh.
But he fell out with Elton
what
in
did
the
he say?
mid-80s.
I'm going for a massage. That's what he said.
Yeah, but played by show favourite Stephen Graham, the great Stephen Graham, whom we love. But apparently he fell out with Elton in the 80s. There was a bit of a court case over royalties. Elton never forgave him. And it does make you wonder how much Elton grudge is going on here. Yeah.
Well, that's what they're saying with the press, that it's not reality. It's a fantasy musical, you know, based around Elton John. But I still feel it's the me. There's no context about other music that was going on at the time, how much he nicked from Bowie, all that stuff. I wanted some other people in there.
It also feels like Elton's got a grudge against everybody that he hasn't got a grudge against. You know, it's like anybody he doesn't know anymore, he doesn't want anything to do with them. Bernie Taupin comes over, obviously great, and that relationship is really fantastic in the movie.
To a large extent, it's basically a platonic love story with Bernie and Elton, isn't it? And Bernie just trying to get Elton to be the best he can be. And sometimes succeeding and sometimes failing. It's pretty harsh on Elton himself, though. I mean, he literally does say, "I started being a cunt in 1974 and never stopped."
Yeah, but he was. it's just honest, isn't it? Yeah. What next are we going to see from Dexter Fletcher, do you think? Smith's biopic?
I'd love
when Morrissey goes, "Well, I've been a bit of a..."
Well, fallout. See, I think this is vastly superior to Bohemian Rhapsody. I think Bohemian Rhapsody, obviously, it's a bit of a cut and shut in that Bryan Singer had made some... Actually, Dexter Fletcher began making Bohemian Rhapsody. It was taken off it. It was given to Bryan Singer and then given back to him. Yeah. And that's, needless to say, I had the last laugh. But for me, Rocketman is much more of a realisation of that style of doing a movie that you can pack an awful lot.
I didn't see Bohemian Rhapsody because I've never liked Queen.
Me neither, really. So. But I did see it for this show. It's kind of, it's impressive, but it's kind of hollow in that the only real character is Freddie. It's Freddie and a bunch of cardboard cutouts.
Well, then we're seeing a theme. I mean, I like the singing detectiveness of it. I like people bursting into song. I thought that was wonderful and could have been made slightly more weird at points.
I wasn't expecting Rocketman to be as it was, you know, which was kind of dark.
But I think that's a fantastic technique, and it would be great if applied to, say, the Smiths, which is you can use a musical number to kind of be like a montage, only better.
Yeah. New Order.
Pack vast amounts of detail in it. One of the sequences manages to get Elton moving from moderate stardom to enormous stardom, from the UK to America. Watford FC, is commencing the use of cocaine and a whole load of other things into like a 2 minute, sung musical thing. Yeah. And I think that's a really great way of packing a huge amount of detail in there.
And I would say it was sold out all weekend. Yeah. So this is not a not popular film. This is getting them in.
My favourite detail is John Reed is sort of stroking it. They've commenced their relationship, which will end in, unsurprisingly, end in tears. John Reed is sort of like stroking the back of Elton's head as he's discussing a combination of business and romance matters. And he just sort of pulls a couple of hairs out. It's just that reference to the fact that Elton's going bald.
Oh, yes.
John's picking the hairs.
That's quite cute, isn't it?
Yeah. But compared with the brutality and the horribleness of the John Reed character.
Well, I also thought that one of my favourite Elton tracks is Benny and the Jets, when he was really at at his worst, his cocaine habit, basically, because it was just absurd, but absolutely fantastic. So I really like the way they do that in the movie.
Yeah. Phil, who would you like to... Dexter Fletcher to tackle next. It's now his modus operandi.
Probably my book.
Your book? Yes. Actually, you know what? That would be fairly entertaining.
Rick Rock the Musical.
I think he could do a good job on that.
So it essentially... I would have thought that Jamie Bell, who plays Bernie Taupin, could probably pull off a decent Phil Savage in this, bursting into song.
It's not all about me, Andrew.
Singing press releases on the desk.
Who'd be Damon?
Who would be Damon? I don't know.
That's the problem. There are real people in the book. Yeah. But, it could be anything. I don't know.
Just let Stephen Graham play everybody. He'd be brilliant. Stephen Graham's Damon Albarn. I'd pay money to see that. Let's move on to the present day and a bit more music. Usually our guests get to choose a tune when they come in, but this week so does Sian. Sian, what have you got and what's it all about?
I've got Earthquake by Tyler, the Creator, the best pop star on the planet at the moment.
And why is he the best pop star on the planet at the moment?
Well, Tyler, the Creator, was always really good and he was part of Odd Future. But he's a tough hip-hop guy. I mean, it's gritty, it's quite scary. He used to be this, you wouldn't really want to bump into him down a dark alleyway. At least I wouldn't, because I'm quite fey. But suddenly he came out, and it took him a long time to come out as gay. And with that, over the last few years, and this sort of celebratory, he's just found this love of melody. He's made a soul record, and the soul record is incredible. He got dumped, apparently, by Will Smith's son, Jaden Smith. And now he's got an Andy Warhol wig, and he wears a white suit, and he's got white DMs, and he's gone fucking mad, and it's amazing. The album is beautiful. It's full of this heartbreak. Suddenly, all this emotion is pouring out. He's worked with Solange. He's worked with all of them. And it's a marvel. I'm slightly obsessed with Tyler, the Creator now. I really am. So Earthquake is from the album. And listen to it. It's just great.
Well, I also thought it was a bit of a boorish get, but what you just told me makes me interested in him.
Extraordinary and an amazing, amazing artiste.
Well, let's have a listen. This is Earthquake. He's going Earthquake by Tyler, comma, the creator. You should make my earthquake. Oh, you should make my earthquake. Riding around and they'll be shaking me up and it's making my heart break. You should make my earthquake. Finally, it's now 20 years since Richard Hawley packed in playing guitar for the Long Pigs. I vividly remember Phil Savage sending me his first solo album and wondering what was the point of a fag-smoking teddy boy in 1999. Hawley has since become one of my favourite artists and he's grown far beyond the modern-day Roy Orbison thing that I was joking about earlier, although he still has the same sensitivity and the 10:30 p.m. in the Labour Club voice that got him going in the first place. Along the way, he's written for Jarvis Cocker, Tony Christie and Lisa Marie Presley. He's been kind of a father figure to the Arctic Monkeys, if only they'd listened a bit more closely. And he's written the music for his own musical about his hometown of Sheffield. Further is his 8th album of high-end dad ballads, and we're going to see what we think of them after this track, Balloon. There could be doubts floating out in space, alone by this bridge staring across the lake, and it makes me feel so alone and unreal. Yeah, it makes me feel. The high-end dad ballad Alone there. Phil used to work with Hawley. Did you always know he had it in him, that he had this sensitive side that would come out?
I'm trying to think back. That was very early. And I remember Richard really being in The Long Pigs.
Yeah.
And then in Pulp.
Yeah.
I remember Richard always standing up for the name Long Pigs, even though I hated it.
It's a terrible name for a band.
Well, I thought it was a terrible name.
And I actually think it killed that band. If they'd had a better name, they might have had Daylight.
I kept saying to Crispin, get rid of that name. But Richard stuck to his guns. So, you know, he's obviously, you know, a man of his own opinion. So that's good. I mean, I love Richard Hawley's voice, you know, and his outlook on life. He's almost the anti-Elton John, isn't he, really?
Yeah.
You know, and I know he shuns, like, the limelight and, you know, it's not about his clothes and it's about, you know, his music and that's it. And that's fine. But, I mean, there's a great track, and my favourite track on this record is There a Pill?
Brilliant record.
Yeah,
good track, yeah.
That's my favourite track because, you know, haven't we always wanted there to be a pill to make you, you know, forget about everything. That's why I see it anyway for that song.
It's an enormously kind of, it's a big wedding cake sort of grandeur ballad thing. And the pill in question is not, let's have this pill and go mental of a Saturday night. It's like, please make my middle-aged woes go away.
Yes.
But I think that's what he's really good at. I mean, this is one of the few artists that I've been able to like turn my dad onto. Because he connects with 50s rock and roll and 60s ballads and all that kind of thing. Lately, he's been... I mean, this is the kind of return to writing tight little songs that, you know, 2 minutes and 51, because he's been on a kind of Ian Sinclair-style urban psychedelia thing with Standing at the Sky's Edge a few years ago, which is all big, long songs and grand sort of splurges of guitar. And this one's back to, you know, those proper melodic songs. What do you think of it, Sean? Are you a Hawley follower?
See, I'm not really a Hawley aficionado. He's one of those people there on in the background, a bit kind of elbowy, but obviously a bit, you know, he does what he does. It's a bit like that. He's not going to just suddenly jump out and do something different. I liked it, but I only liked it. I thought Doors is a beautiful song, which is the last song in. Yeah. I really enjoyed that, but a lot of them seem very similar. They're very similar tempo. It's all in the same sort of range. So it can sort of drift in and out a bit. You can forget you're listening to it. It's one of those. But I don't mind him, but that's a bit damning, isn't it?
There's a track called My Little Treasures, which is lovely as well, which I presume about his children, but it might be all like the lovely little treasures.
Apparently, it's not apparently, and this is, I discovered this by top research by reading the press release.
Okay.
Apparently, it's about friends of his dad. The song's been kicking around since about 2007, and it's about friends of his dad who died in 2007 that he ran into again. And sort of like trying to think about his dad through his dad's mates and how seeing his dad's mates made him feel, because he was really close to his father and his father was part of what got him on the road to music. And that sort of thing of you know, all the bits of your life that maybe you don't really pay close attention to, that perhaps you should pay closer attention to because they're going to be gone pretty quickly. What I find really, I mean, you know, you're saying, Sean, you find it a bit backgroundy. I wonder whether you have to be a bloke of a certain age to really get it.
Yeah,
because his music actually kind of does get me properly where I live. It's like, it reminds me of the records my mum and dad used to play when I was a kid. That sort of mixture of kind of Radio 2, two-way family favourites thing. Even sort of pre-rock and roll music with big grand ballads, Sunday nights at the London Palladium, you know, Hawley would often play in front of big velvet curtains.
There's a bit of the record that reminds me of, you know, when Iggy was trying to, I mean, obviously I'm a massive Iggy fan, and then during the 80s he was trying to become a bit more rock and roll, that Wild Child, all that kind of stuff. Richard's voice reminds me of 80s Iggy, I think, really.
Yeah.
There's a bit of Divine Comedy in there somewhere, which
is
unusual.
It's a bit Divine Comedy. You know, obviously the kind of inspirations are really ancient rock and roll. It's Buddy Holly.
Yeah.
Even, go with me on this one, I think there's a bit of Max Bygraves in there.
Whoa.
I mean, Max Bygraves, king of cheese, and it was terrible, terrible music, but there was a grain to that voice.
I got a bit of
light entertainment. Yeah.
Gordon Lightfoot, and I love Gordon Lightfoot. And I can see what he's trying to do, but yes, maybe it just misses the...
But also, he made a record with Tony Christie, and Tony Christie is one of those incredible British, you know, that were made light entertainment into more than light entertainment, had something to say. And I think he's an heir to that. He's also, I was joking about Roy Orbison, but he kind of is a reincarnation of that. Something else that struck me from this is basically a Morrissey record without tears. It's a Morrissey record without Morrissey. It's got everything that made Morrissey's music good before Morrissey himself became so personally repellent. And you've got that sort of 50s feel. You've got, you know, beautiful, like, nimble, expressive guitar playing, and then the occasional banging rocker. You feel you've been transported into a bit of neglected Britain. Sean's gurning here.
Yeah, there's the self-hatred. There's the edge that Morrissey has that from the early records that I don't get here. I get lots of smooth over. And I know he's singing about heartbreak and complicated things, but it is a very smooth sounding...
Irrespective of Morrissey's current antics, I'm tired of the self-loathing that drives it, because there comes a stage in life when you sort of mellow a little bit to the world.
Well, you want to say pull yourself together? Is that what you mean?
You just fall to pieces in different ways, Phil. I think so. I actually
should have been Elton's manager.
Yeah, I mean, that track you mentioned, Doors, though,
with that line,
you've opened up the doors of your mind, you know, which is rather cosmic for a...
But you can't shut them again. It doesn't sound as if it's an altogether
unless you take a pill.
Thing.
It's very men dealing with their feelings, which is a big, difficult thing. Sean is grimacing like mad.
I wouldn't know about that.
Phil, you knew Roy Orbison. Do you think he would have liked this?
I think he would, yes. He probably would be still wearing his dressing gown, took him out of the shower, but he would... I think he'd have loved Richard's voice, yes.
Let's go and lay down some tracks.
Yeah.
Because Roy Orbison died very young, didn't he? He's like
52.
December
the
6th, 1988. He was my age when he died.
When I met him, I thought he was a really old man, and that's quite scary.
52 was old.
But then 52 was 52 then, isn't it?
It's and not also, now. As you just described earlier in the show, they smoked their heads off.
Yeah.
You know,
he'd had a triple heart bypass 10 years before, and he smoked like a chimney. So
It was coming, wasn't it? Anyway, I like the Richard Hawley album, and I commend it to the listeners.
Wonderful. It's time for another tune. This time it's Phil's choice. What you got, Phil?
Well, it's funny you should say that, because obviously I knew what track I wanted to play, and then I realised now you want me to know something about the band, which I do a bit. Fat White Family, Feet. They remind me of the Happy Mondays, if the Happy Mondays were recording music now, I think, kind of like scuzzy rock. And I think I like this track mainly because it uses the word Caucasian in it. And I can't think of any other songs that do that, really. They've obviously got a member of the band called Alex White. So is there a member called Mr. Fat as well? I don't know. Should be really. But yeah, I think I really like this track. So I hope you do too.
It's obviously funky. What would Savage and Best have done with them?
Well, that's funny, because I was just thinking yesterday that this is the kind of band I would have made up, because towards the end of the Britpop thing, when I got bored, I made up bands with names like Ponce and Pond Life, and got them in a Ponce split up for sexual differences. Pond Life but they were Camp Indie, and Pond Life just split up because they were boring. But they only split up because journalists used to ring me up and going, we've written something in the gossip column about them, but can we hear their music now? So I thought, God, this is getting ridiculous. So I split them up. Fat White Family are like a made-up Savage and Best band.
Fantastic.
Amazing. Here's Feet by Fat White Family.
Coming to the end of the show, which means closing time chatter. What will our guests be discussing over a bottle of Metz or Hooch or Smirnoff Ice on the steps of the Good Mixer with Annie from Elastica and Johnny from Menswear? Sean, what's your closing time chatter for this week?
Well, I went to see favourite of mine, Leigh Kayleigh, 47, last week. Her first show in Britain ever, actually, didn't realise, and it was incredible. It was in London's trendy Hoxton, and in the end, there were 15 people voguing up on stage with her. It was very camp and very wonderful. But I'm getting to that age where I'm thinking, I'm the granny down the front. And it made me think, where are rave grannies now? Do you remember when you used to go places and there's always an 80-year-old with lots of plastic flowers in her hair? And she's going to be there from the start to the finish of the evening, probably not take lots of drugs, but from indie gigs to proper rave-ups and warehouse things in Clapham, you'd see the rave grannies. I mean, presumably some of them may have died. Sorry to say that, listen.
But it's a high attrition lifestyle.
The new generation of rave grannies, ravegranny.com. I mean, here we could go, you know, we could start it, we'd get people together, the social media, something like that. And a big swell, because where are you when you are getting a little bit older? Everybody's 18 at a gig. It's difficult. But yeah, I'm a support group maybe for people like me.
We frequently did, when I was doing Mixmag, two stints editing Mixmag, we would often do the feature about old clubbers. Let's meet some older clubbers. Yeah. And they're like, here's a man, he's 50 years old and he still goes out dancing. Isn't that incredible and amazing? Have you ever heard of such a thing? He may well die of old age in the middle of, you know, act periods too, by hardcore.
Yes.
You know.
Yeah, how can he not go to the toilet?
I know, he calls his carer. So yeah, I was that guy.
Yeah. Yeah, but yeah, it's happened to us now.
If I could be controversial and do the same closing time chatter almost, but with twist, which is that I think now they have raves at Ministry of Sound where the people are doing aerobics the entire time to music with no drugs allowed, no alcohol allowed. That's really interesting. And I also know that maybe rave grannies, if they exist, it's in a slightly different way. I know some people who took a lot of drugs in the 90s and went to Ibiza a lot and now go to Finsbury Park and just basically pump iron to music in Finsbury Park on their own. And that's their way of getting out their dance, you know, shtick or
getting
whatever. I think that's where rave grannies have been gone.
Mm. So are we really saying that we thought raving was the point and the central tenet of the whole carry-on, but actually raving was just one way of doing the thing that you needed to do, which was overload your body and get a bit of a sweat on?
Well, get to do some aerobics. Yeah. That's possibly true.
But depressing thought.
Rave music didn't take over America for quite a long time because ecstasy was so expensive. Like, you know, 50 quid a tab.
But it's also collective experience. It's how do you take part in the collective experience when you get older and everyone's younger, because you get that euphoria with, you know, you can have a bottle of water and all that sort of thing, but you still need to go out and get that little transcendent feeling.
I think yoga raves and breakfast raves and all these things are a disgrace. They shouldn't be happening at all. My closing chatter is an amazing thread on the Twitter by TV and comics writer Amanda Debert, who writes Teen Titans Go and Batman 77. And she just asked, what's a cool bit of family history that you know? Just asked her following this. And the stuff that came out will blow your mind. Everything from the woman who described when her grandmother was going to hospital to give birth to her mother, the car packed up. And her great-grandmother tried to flag down a car to take them to the hospital. And they were given a lift to the hospital by a young couple called Bonnie and Clyde. To Bonnie and Clyde. Oh, they are the reason that the family exists at all. Bonnie and Clyde took her to the hospital. Or the other guy, I mean, a lot of this stuff is American because the woman's following is American. The guy whose grandfather, or great-grandfather rather, had to dig up the body of his great-grandmother and transport it across America because in order to hold on to his ranch, you had to have a wife on the property. So he had to carry the corpse of his wife. Somebody else who said that they were related to Joel Robert Poinsett, diplomat, world traveller and the first US Minister of Mexico, after whom the poinsettia is named. And then she posted a picture of him and he's the dead spit of Joe Strummer. It's like Joe Strummer was the first US Minister to Mexico and invented the poinsettia. Wonderful. So I added my own family claim to fame.
Oh, did you? Which is?
My nan used to work in Benrose's The Printer with George Harrison's mum. Mm. And George Harrison's mum was an object of pity for all the girls on the line because she thought, it's so awful. Her George has gone and joined a group and they've gone to Germany and he's definitely going to become a drug addict and die. And they thought it was the worst thing that ever happened until George came back from Hamburg with a Cuban heel boot full of £5 notes. And after that, all the girls on the line thought, George is the best one in the Beatles.
He was.
So I added that was my contribution. I'm going to put it on our Facebook page and also social media. You can add your own because it needs more of a UK bias on this as well.
It sounds a bit like Home Truths as well that John Peel used to
present a lot
on Radio
like
4, which I loved, which was the minor details that were getting bigger and bigger about people's families.
Like, for instance, a dad who would say, why are you going to London to buy trousers? We've got plenty of trousers in Canton, for instance.
Yes, that's one of my favourites in my dad's expressions.
Yeah. Phil Savage's dad. Phil, thanks for coming in. Are you going to take the book on a world tour and then cancel dates like Elton and John?
I'm exactly going to do that. I've already cancelled four today, yes.
Fantastic. Entirely entertaining read. Lunch with the Wild Frontiers, available in a bookshop near you right now. Phil's going to stick around for the extra bit, where we choose our personal highs and lows of the Britpop era. Patreon people, the extra bit will be with you soon. Thanks for listening. In the meantime, thanks to producer Elsie Bath. Sean and I will see you next week.
Bye-bye. Bye.